pray observe the magnanimity we present to Lace and Dimity. Never was such opportunity to get married with impunity. We shall quickly be personified, conjugally matrimonified, by a doctor of divinity who is located in this vicinity.
Would that be me?
I guess it could be, sir. Are you gonna marry me?
I'm taken, Chris, but thanks very much for the offer. Of course, it is legal now in Great Britain.
And also, it's a bit contextual because as we're recording this, I'm in a Gilbert and Sullivan show.
I was going to ask, is it Princess Ida that you're recording?
Oh, that was actually Pirates of Penzance, but it mentioned Doctors of Divinity and all that. So, yeah, I thought I'd get it out there. That's one of my other
hats.
Other hats?
It's your other hat. It's a pirate hat in this case, sort of three pointed.
Yeah, generally. We do wear hats when we're on stage because I'm a baldy, so they don't like unless your character's specifically meant to be bald. You generally have
unless it says in the directions.
Yeah, it generally has to be wigs and hats and all sorts of things. So it's good. Moving swiftly on, I'm Christopher Carter,
and I'm Dr. David Robertson, and Oh, it's not. I'm not tired of that yet. So
we're gonna have to change this sort of link, and it'll be like, "Welcome to the Religious Studies Project with Christopher
Mister Mister
Special Host, Doctor David Robertson."
We'll be doing this all again in another year's time. I have no doubt about that. Yeah.
Glad someone does it.
So this week's interview is another from Dave McConaughey, and it's with Sean McLeod on the question of, or the subject of, spiritual warfare.
I'm here today with Sean McLeod, who is Associate Professor and Director of Graduate Studies at UNC Charlotte. He teaches on religion and modern culture, and in religious studies. He's the author of Making the American Religious Fringe, Exotics, Subversives, and Journalists, 1955 to 1993, Divine Hierarchies, Class in American Religion and Religious Studies, and he's the co-editor of Religion and Class in America, Culture, History, and Politics. Today we're here to talk about our mutual interests in spiritual warfare, demons, exorcisms, and all that kind of stuff that normally don't people talk about in the Academy very much, and it's all in his new book, which is tentatively titled, or officially titled, perhaps. He's saying officially, nodding his head, American Possession. So, Sean, welcome to the Religious Studies Podcast.
Hi, thank you very much, David. And it is still tentative.
Tentative.
Still having discussions with Oxford University Press about it. It seems like American Possessions may not say enough, so there might have to be a pithy subtitle other than Fighting Demons in the Contemporary United States. Sure. We'll see, though. We'll see. It's not a boring subject, is it?
No, it's exciting. Very exciting. So what are the kind of things you talk about? What's the framework that you're using to kind of approach this rather delicate material?
Yeah, so I, if I might back up and say that I first became interested in this through just a happenstance meeting with a student I had at Central Michigan University, where a student came into my office and he told me he was very, very tired. And I said that I had imagined that it was probably because he had been at a party all night, because that's what happens in colleges like that. But so I asked him, and he said he had been up all night doing a prayer walk.
Yeah.
I said, what's a prayer walk? He proceeded to tell me how he'd just come from a conference in Dearborn, Michigan, of Spiritual Warfare Network and Peter Wagner, that he had learned how to pray and find out with a small group of his friends where the demons were, as he phrased it, in Mount Pleasant, Michigan, and they proceeded to do a walk with holy oil and a set of prayers to various places. So they went to a Masonic temple, they went to something they called a Native American tree on the campus, they went to a Mormon house, there's no temples anywhere near there, so it was a house, and they also went to a gay-friendly bar called Rubbles. And they said prayers out in front, and they were throwing oil, and he said that there were actual demons living in these places.
Right.
That was my first experience with spiritual warfare, and it fascinated me, and ever since I've been wanting to write about it.
That's fascinating. So Did you find out next that Dearborn, Michigan happened to be a hotspot of this, or was this an aberration? How did things unfold from that point?
I did ask why the conference was in Dearborn, and I almost said the student's name. I won't say the student's name.
Please.
But it was they had chosen to have it there because it has a large Middle Eastern population,
absolutely,
a large Muslim population.
That's right where I was headed.
So they were there hoping to do their own prayer walks.
That's
and
right.
When I say there, it was Peter Wagner and his group.
Yeah, and the Sentinel group with George Otis.
Exactly.
Right?
And you mentioned George Otis here because, of course, George Otis is what we might think of as the founder of prayer walks.
Territorial and
spiritual mapping. Yeah, yes.
Absolutely.
So they were doing their own work in Dearborn.
Yes, they were.
But they had a conference to bring in and teach other people in that part of the Great Lakes region about this and then send their troops out, if you will. They do use a lot of military language.
Yes, they do.
Right. So the student thought of himself as part of an army at that point.
Right. So let's break it down for people that may,
yes,
may have known. So we're talking about a group of evangelicals.
Yeah, a very particular group of evangelicals, right? Because there are lots of different kind of evangelicals. These, however, at least the people I'm interested in, because there are lots of groups that do spiritual warfare.
A lot of different kinds of
evangelicals. And different kinds of spiritual warfare.
And even people that are not in the evangelical tradition.
Lots exactly, exactly. But I'm interested in a group that comes out of Peter Wagner's work at Fuller Theological Seminary in
right.
the mid and late 1980s.
Right, as part of their school for world missions.
He was part of world missions school, and he was wanting to do a couple things. First, implement charismatic practices more into evangelical work in general.
Right.
And also, through the mission field, had started to develop a theology that really was a demonology.
Yes.
And he dubbed, I think it was in 1988, he dubbed the movement he was part of as the third wave of evangelicalism. So first you have Pentecostalism, you have the charismatic movement of the early 1970s, and now a new move of the Holy Spirit that included things such as spiritual warfare and more attention to the demons and angels.
Right.
As we're living in the end times, there's a battle that's raging.
Right, absolutely, and I'm holding myself back from jumping
and don't
in,
please
ahead
don't
in the conversation here because Kashawn and I are working on exactly the same material. So I'm trying to make sure that all the people that are listening can be in on the juicy bits of the conversation. So we have Wagner, and we have him in the emerging third wave evangelical movement, which today more people would be familiar with that as the New Apostolic Reformation. That's kind of their current iteration.
Exactly, but, and there are, 12 or 15 different parachurch organizations
right.
that Wagner and his friends, if you will, have started.
Highly.
Yeah. And I say his friends, but really part of the New Apostolic Reformation is that there are groups of people that consider themselves special intercessors and apostles. Cindy Jacobs being one,
absolutely,
for example. We can name a lot of people. Alice Patterson.
Yeah, we can. And what makes all of these people distinct for Wagner, and we should never forget to mention John Wimber and their
relationship
at Fuller. So we're talking about something that came out of the Vineyard Charismatic movement and then moved into the more mainstream Fuller Theological Seminary. But Wagner's position was everyone has a unique spiritual gift, right? The Holy Spirit has blessed everyone in a very particular way, whether it, maybe for you it's healing, maybe for this other person it's the ability to discern demons, to identify if there is a demon in a particular place. Maybe your spiritual gift is actually get rid of those demons, right? So identifying your particular spiritual gift is absolutely at the core of the third wave kind of hierarchy of, if you're a member of the church, what kind of member are you going to be? The answer is you're going to be one that uses spiritual gifts.
That's right. And there are handbooks that train special intercessors for spiritual warfare.
Extensive handbooks.
Yes. And in fact, the focus of American Possessions, even though I interviewed people for it, it's not a fieldwork study. It's really a focus intensely on spiritual warfare manuals, which are different kinds of books in that there's not just one type of spiritual warfare manual. There are handbooks for delivering demons out of human bodies, out of objects. So there's a genre of literature called spiritual house cleaning literature.
Yep. Yeah, so if you have a... If you feel there's an oppressive force in your home, maybe someone might come in and they might realize that on the wall you have what you thought was an innocuous painting, but that painting really has some sort of idol or spiritual entity, and it's been attached by a negative demon. And so spiritual house cleaning is the way to identify and then get rid of those kind of objects. And
exactly.
Do you know the story about Peter Wagner and the jaguars?
Oh, of course, yes.
Why don't you tell that story? Because that's a great spiritual house cleaning.
It's a great spiritual house cleaning story, and it's typical in some ways of the early stories of possessed objects, because on the mission field, evangelical missionaries would sometimes purchase things, right? And they would bring statues home, thinking it was a pretty dog, it was a pretty jaguar, whatever. But Peter Wagner himself has the story of how he brought home an object that had demons in it that had to be exorcised. In one of my interviews, I think this is a fascinating example for me. A guy who was in his mid-20s, his parents were members of a holiness church, and they were thought to be the best intercessors at getting rid of demons. In his household, they would regularly go through the entire house and pray to make sure no demons had lodged themselves in things. When they bought him toys as a child, they would sometimes find that the toys had demons in them. Sometimes it was about the toy itself, that the toy drew demons in. Sometimes it was something that the child had done that invited a demon into the toy. They would pray over them, and if they found a toy that had a demon in it, similar to if you found a book, if you found a picture, you'd have to get rid of it after saying some prayers. You would sometimes smash it. You might burn it. He had his toy smashed and burned, for example.
Right.
I'm trying to think. I'm guessing, if I remember right, the jaguar was probably smashed at some point.
It
had to be removed, obviously.
It had to be removed immediately. I don't remember what happened to it. I think they threw it in the trash.
Yeah.
It's actually.
Yeah. If you can't break it.
But I've never seen a picture of it. But I wasn't picturing a small jaguar.
Right.
I was picturing a rather substantial,
a very large, heavy statue.
Table, like lamp-sized sculpture that we're talking about.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so when he brought it back from Bolivia or.
Yes.
South America, and it seemed rather innocuous, but here was a spirit entity, right? This is a powerful creature in indigenous, beliefs in South America, right? He brought it into his home, and they felt, sincerely believed that the entry of that object into that home had been a door that they had opened into their own personal space for this negative entity that they were, was ruining their religious sensibilities. So causing them to have sleepless nights, causing them to feel agitated and not be able to pray, and all of these other spiritual consequences.
And it was also physical manifestations of spirits.
Yeah,
so in Third Wave of the Holy Spirit, when he's first, I think that's the first time he tells that story in literature, in the 1988 book, maybe?
There's an earlier article that he, that he wrote.
From Charisma, perhaps?
Not from Charisma, no. It was, I think it was the special issue of Christianity Today when he was responding to the controversy over his Fuller course. That I think that's where he
I see.
But, you know, 3 or 4 years. He's only been telling the story for, 10 years at that point.
But he does have that point in which he's retelling that story of he's out of town and his wife sees the green spirit figure at the foot of the bed that appears. Apparently the same color as the jade jaguar.
Yeah.
Right. So fascinating. Chuck Pierce tells a similar story about how he's in New Orleans. He buys a beautiful ceramic cat, only to find out later that that cat houses occult demons inside of it. And he phrases it occult demons. And this is another interesting thing about spiritual warfare, at least from the group of folks who were in Third Wave, New Apostolic Reformation. The notion of selves and history and individuals. So Chuck Pierce felt that the demons were not just naturally in that object, but they were in the object because his family had had a history of demons of the occult in the family. He talked about an uncle who could, with his occult powers, kill wasps and various insects in the house. Take care of problems that way, right? And that he was attracted to this object because of what he thinks of as generational inheritance. So it's really fascinating to me that here in a very contemporary period in which, it's sort of that classic liberal/neoliberal concept of the self is totally disengaged from everything. We can be anybody we want to be. Right. Here's a movement that has a conception that we're still very closely tied to family, to history, that things can't just be so easily gotten rid of. Yeah. And compare that to, you know, the notion of conversion in an evangelical sense of new birth.
That's right.
And how that complicates that notion, that it's not just a one-time event, but in fact, part of this form of spiritual warfare is the notion that demons will come back. And sometimes they'll come back with their friends once you get rid of them. That this is a lifetime battle. This isn't a one-time event.
Yeah, no, it really changes your entire perception of history, of prophecy and apocalypticism, right? You're not going to be waiting for that moment to be whisked away, right? You have to continually battle and renew your battle every day and find new ways to participate and new ways to identify the enemy at every moment because it's a shape-shifting. Right? The enemy can be in anything and can be anywhere and be in anyone, and it is constant vigilance. But it's historically minded. It's a historical vigilance, which means that not only have to be concerned about the present day, but you have to be sensitive to the way in which the past is running through the past to the present, continuing to have all these manifestations. So it seems like you feel the way I feel about it, which is that not only are they really spatially sensitive, they're also very temporally sensitive. They
precisely
care about particular places and particular times, and the way they care about those is to frame them in this larger cosmic struggle.
Yeah, and I think it's well, I don't think. I think we both know that it's common frequently for people who don't study this movement to get a laugh out of it, to think how silly it is. But really, whether you like or dislike the politics, which can be horrific at times, granted.
It can be very, very challenging.
It can. But it's a very complex conception of self that this movement has, because it is so intensely tied to history, to generational inheritances from family, to the notion that history just doesn't matter for individuals, but for actual places and spaces, as you notice.
Yeah, and that's, of course, I think, part of the difference between where Sean and I are both happy to meet one another, right, and happy that we can do our own kind of mutual thing, because I care a lot about the places and spaces, and I think you care a bit more, not only about the materiality of the objects, the consumption, right, but also about more about the people and the kind of discourses that they're having.
Exactly.
So I think we have complementary interests that are exposing both sides of the process, right? So I'm pleased, right? Like, oh, you know, please don't step on my territory. Oh, wait, no. We're going to be helpful to one another, right? This is going to advance things forward.
And I know of at least two or, well, no, that's not true, three other people who have worked or are in the process of putting out books, articles, dissertations on the subject of spiritual warfare, and but in good, serious ways. And I have to say I'm pretty excited about what I might be seeing coming out in the next two or three years.
Oh, yeah, by the end of 10 years, let's say, from now, right? Because I think if you're working on a dissertation now, I met a very nice graduate student last night who gate crashed a party just to come and say hello to some of us. And he's working on what he thinks is the root of why all the spiritual warfare emerged. And I think he differs from you and I on it. He believes that it is the interaction with metaphysical stuff that really kind of produced it. And I think from what I've read of your work, you seem to fall kind of more in the therapeutic side of things and the neoliberal side of things, and I seem to fall more on the missional side of things. I think it really happened in the missional kind of moment. So I think, like...
And I don't think I disagree with you at all,
I agree with you, and I think we both agree with him, and it's all of those things. But you can't write, you know, about it the first time round and have all of those things.
Yeah,
right?
But I think the point to be made is that this form, at least, of spiritual warfare would not exist without mission.
Absolutely.
Right? Yeah. Because this is where the demonologies are created, in essence, are developed.
I think too, though, that your work in the chapter that I think you sent me while I was still finishing my dissertation, that chapter convinced me that I had not given serious enough thought to the therapeutic elements and that conversation's effect on it. All right, so I think we should talk a little bit more about what you're specifically working on in this, and then we can branch out from there, I think, into all kinds of different things after. So tell us a bit more about that.
Something that strikes me about contemporary spiritual warfare is how it's not so radically different thematically and its interests and its languages than a lot of contemporary American religion. So the arguments that this is something out in left field really isn't true, I don't think. And the particular themes that I think that you see in spiritual warfare that you see in other parts of the contemporary American religious landscape is, first of all, I name them the haunted. So the kind of vibrant, robust supernaturalism that we see in the United States, and it's not, and I'm not making an argument that any of these things are new. I mean, of course, Americans have always believed in ghosts, supernatural powers. They've always done a lot of things. But there are certain periods when it garners more media attention, more focus. And it seems that we're in a period right now in which it's nearly impossible, say, to turn on a television with all the cable channels we have and not be able to watch five or six different ghost shows, not just within a week, but perhaps in a couple days. Yeah. And in fact, you know, we were talking earlier about possessed objects. In American popular culture, there is now a genre of literature that sounds like spiritual house cleaning about possessed possessions.
Yes.
There's even a television show called Possessed Possessions. The Haunted Collector is another one. So the haunted is a theme that is not particular to spiritual warfare, notion of demons doing the hauntings in that case versus, say, your Aunt Tilly who's coming back from the dead.
And that's the fascinating distinction, right?
Yeah.
How is this an evangelical object?
How's it unique, and how does it also, though, borrow from and influence wider things in American culture? Because things are very tied closely together. I think one example of this is a lot of ghost hunting shows and authors of ghost hunting books. Talk about 3 a.m. being the haunting hour, the witching hour. What does that mean? It seems as far, and maybe you know this better than I do, but I've traced this to evangelical notions that 3 p.m. is kind of a folk time for Jesus to die on the cross. And the opposite is 3 a.m. So this comes from Catholic popular culture, but evangelical popular culture as well. And in fact, the spiritual warfare manuals mention 3 a.m. as a significant time. I think, in particular, Rebecca Greenwood's works.
Right. Well, I know that the prayer walk that I went on was a bright and early 8 a.m.
Because 3 a.m. is much too late.
Well, yeah. I think there's some public sphere issues that you run into.
Oh, right.
That, right? But if you're on
doing something in a home,
you're right there.
Yeah.
I think there's some additional issues. But I think you're right that there's that willingness to borrow, right?
Yes.
It may not be an acknowledged borrowing.
No.
But there is the willingness to at least consider its possibility if, and that's the big asterisk, right, if they can make a claim for its publicity, right, if we can show a valid warrant for this claim we're making in the Bible, and if we can validate that with some sort of approval from the Holy Spirit telling us that we're moving in the right direction.
And the approval from the Holy Spirit is sometimes, if you look at writers like Ed Murphy of the Large Spiritual Warfare Handbook, for him, that trumps the fact that it may not be mentioned in the Bible.
Right.
So if it's not mentioned in the Bible, but you feel that the Holy Spirit's moving you this way, he talks about this, right?
Yeah.
Because a lot of criticisms that other evangelicals, and I would say, you know, it's mostly other evangelicals that criticize the movement because people outside of evangelical don't even know the movement.
No. Bob Larson said specifically to me when I interviewed him that his biggest critics, and Bob Larson is a spiritual warfare pastor who's out in California, in the kind of desert part of California, mm-hmm. Outside of Los Angeles. And he said very specifically, no. The place where he got the biggest flack, the place that it always has been our biggest role is other evangelicals.
Yes.
That's who targets us and says that we are a danger to evangelicalism on the whole. Right? We're threatening the boat,
mm-hmm.
our presence.
In fact, there's I don't remember the names of the editors, but you probably know the work that came out last fall through Baker Academic on spiritual warfare, and it was four different views. And the Peter Wagner and Rebecca Greenwood's essay was the one that was attacked most fiercely by the other authors. In fact, they were all ganging up.
I think Wagner has that kind of target, right, that he has made of himself. His course at Fuller made him the target of intense scrutiny from his peers at the school. It made him the target of intense scrutiny around the country and put Fuller under the microscope, and his peers did not appreciate that. And then in the continuing work that he's done, he feels as if all of the rest of his work has further put evangelicals under the microscope.
And at the same time, it's his work at Fuller that garnered all this interest that started, in essence, a very particular type of evangelicalism. I mean, I wonder if in 50 years people will be talking about him as quite an important figure in some ways, along with Wimber.
I think what's surprised me the most was that when I was researching this, you must have researched him, the only biographical information you can get on him is his own autobiography.
Right.
Right, that's it. There's no secondary biographical, you know, picture, short essay. You know, there's an entry in the who's who of evangelicalism, and that's it, right? There's no secondary critical commentary about the
correct.
Role that he's
yeah,
doing. Yeah, no, absolutely. 50 years, like, they will say this was a guy that was at the center of something very interesting.
But you know, so the haunted was one of these themes, right? But there are two others that I think of as well that seems to be represented in spiritual warfare, but also in the wider American culture. And one is consumerism, the consumerists, evangelicals like the third wave new apostolic reformation folks. They're in between spots here in that they very explicitly, and I'm thinking of Cindy Jacobs, Alice Patterson, support certain forms of neoliberal capitalism. Free trade, and in fact, I find it fascinating, Kevin Lewis O'Neill just mentioned this, right, how missionizing follows free trade agreements, so spiritual warfare in South Korea, in Guatemala, in Nicaragua.
Absolutely, and we should note that those are the very places that spiritual warfare around the globe has been most successful.
Yes.
And back and forth in that terms of
exactly
trans-Pacific and trans-Caribbean, I guess.
Yeah, and this is truly transnational. Yeah, this is mutual influence back and forth. So they're very much in support of this. Yet at the same time, they realize in their theology, these sorts of contacts, these sorts of objects literally bring demons. Right, because they come from cultures that are sometimes not Christian, and that could be dangerous.
Right.
So go back to the Jaguar story. But also American popular culture, something that they both want to utilize, at the same time have to be very, very wary of.
Right. So they're happy about The Conjuring, even though they might worry, right, that The Conjuring's portrait of spiritual warfare might lead people to mock them, right, or think of what they do as, you know, comical or only for fiction's sake.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, or in general, certain forms of popular culture can bring on the demonic through individuals' intentions if they misread a particular movie in a certain way, right?
Right. So this is, you know, video games and television making us more violent, right, or more sexualized. Is that the kind of direction you're going with it?
Well, with the exception, though, that we have actual demons that appear, right? So I mean, a lot of Americans may think that, but very few Americans actually add a actual demon that can house itself physically in someone's body or in that DVD that you have at home.
So it's a very literal spiritual reading of Poltergeist.
Exactly. That doesn't look different than a way a lot of other people think and act, except it's much more explicit. So again, it doesn't look so different from a lot of other things going on. And then the third that I think you mentioned earlier is I'm fascinated by how spiritual warfare manuals sometimes not always, right? And obviously there are big differences, but sometimes share a therapeutic language with the wider culture. And I think first and foremost of the work that Katie Lofton's done with Oprah in terms of the language of self-help. But you look at, I think a good example is Chuck Smith and his wife have put out a couple spiritual warfare handbooks that use phrasings that if you were to take out the sentence or two here and there that's specifically about Jesus, it could be something that Oprah Winfrey would have had on her show or have in her magazine.
Yeah.
They even talk about, if you remember the book The Secret.
Yeah.
And,
it's like you're not allowed to forget.
What exactly? But what, the good that you put out in the world comes back to you threefold. Phrases like this are repeated word for word in spiritual warfare manuals from time to time, especially the ones that are focused on individuals and the development of individual spirituality. So it's fascinating, right? Because it shares a language with groups that would be very seriously demonized. So the theology, philosophy of The Secret is seen as literally demonic.
Isn't that fascinating?
It is.
They were able to turn that on its head. And what strikes me is that the spiritual warfare people have done that with all three of the items that you're talking about.
Yeah.
And have done it successfully. And so on haunting, right, they're able to turn it to their advantage. On consumerism, they're able to find their own way to turn that to their advantage. And finally, on if we think, right, that all of these things are there, and then we look at what the critics say are the real problems with the movie, they're the same three problems, right? The critics say, hey, you're using the language of therapy. That's metaphysical stuff. That's new thought stuff. You shouldn't have anything to do with that, right? So Hank Hanegraaff,
website
Deception in the Church, right? That's exactly the criticism they came up with. They're like, that's Middle Eastern and Asian stuff, and you're bringing it right in here and treating as if it's Christian, right? And the consumerism and they're saying a lot of the same things, right? You're selling out.
Mm-hmm.
This is you being a marketing person, not you being a person of faith. Right? And the haunting, and then they're saying, like, no, you're just seeing demons everywhere. Like, once you're looking for them, they're everywhere.
Right.
Right? And those are the things that spiritual warfare is able to take from these other places and turn to great effect. They get criticized for their evangelical peers for doing that with those things.
And yet at the same time, from a perspective from a scholar of American religion, an interest in American religion, they don't look much different than even in some cases those very evangelicals who are criticizing them.
Although the subjects would be horrified. Of course. So this is the scholarly distance that we can bring to this study that
exactly.
An outsider might not be able to articulate.
Exactly. In fact, I would suggest that the usage of therapeutic idioms and phrasings, I don't think these are fully conscious things. This is common American parlance, and whether you're a spiritual warfare practitioner, whether you're an atheist, a United Methodist, you probably... You're mining from that same grotto, right? You live in that same period within that same milieu, and you're using that phrasing. People like us who have lots of time to sit back and just write about this and study it that even recognizes this.
So that makes it sound as if that this is a particularly American phenomenon. I know that in America we can find it manifested so powerfully, I think, right? Just the, kind of number of volumes that we could point to that are written by American evangelicals, it's dozens.
Yes.
Titles. I have an entire shelf.
Yes.
In my office devoted to it. So one of the words of caution, though, that I know that we should put to everyone is that we said that it was transnational.
Right.
I think it's even more transnational than we're letting on, the impression we might give that it's so American in its kind of idiom, right? So do you want to say a few words about maybe about some of those global connections?
Yeah, you could probably say a lot more than I could about it. And I think something that I want to make sure I do in the book, and hopefully I do it clearly, is not to assume that at this point we can even talk about American religion of any sort without talking about transnationalism, right, and what talking about flows between different places. And I think, if anything, this contemporary spiritual warfare movement we're talking about is a great example of that.
It is.
Again, it would not exist, as we said earlier, without the mission field initially.
Right.
And the places that you find it growing the most isn't actually anywhere in the United States,
that
boundaries.
America had its moment for this, and it has passed. I think,
and now we find it in Central America. We
right.
find it in Africa. We find it in Indonesia.
That's right.
We find it in South Korea.
That's right.
There are other places you're probably thinking of that I didn't mention. South America as well, of course.
They tried to do it in Japan.
Not as successful there.
No, it hasn't been successful, but they tried.
Yeah.
They tried repeatedly to do it. And I think we're seeing more and more that they're trying to do it in China as well. And unfortunately, I'm not a linguist who was able to really take advantage of some of the resources. I think that is a problem. Maybe this is a time to make a clarion call. If you work in Asian evangelicalism,
yeah.
maybe you should contact us, and we can try to help you with the sources on our end. And you can provide the linguistic and ethnographic and cultural means that would really help put that forward.
No, that would be wonderful.
So, let's talk a little bit more about the kind of secular and religious byproducts of this. Because I know, so if we're talking about consumerism, and we're talking about neoliberalism, and we're talking about therapeutic kind of things, like, these are all in the cultural waters, right? They're the American milieu. So just as we want to emphasize the transnationalism, right, we probably also want to emphasize the outward movement of this religious stuff into what might be the non-religious or the secular sphere. So do you think that this group is having an effect on the American cultural experience broadly?
Yeah, that's an excellent question, and I'm really wary to...
His eyebrows are raised there.
They are. I'm really wary to, again, pinpoint which way the influence is going in specific incidents. But, 100% I would agree with you that this is mutual. It's not as if, and sometimes you hear the critics of this third wave form of spiritual warfare saying, well, you get this from popular ghost culture. But is that actually true? Because in some cases, it seems that it's the evangelical spiritual warfare idioms that are making their way into popular supernatural culture in the United States. In fact, it's so muddied, right, that it becomes in some ways almost impossible in the contemporary period to find an origin to
right.
some of these stories.
Right. So maybe that's a good structural question for us, right? So you said earlier that you deal primarily with texts, although you have done interviews.
Mm-hmm.
That's what I ended up doing as well. I did some, I don't know if you've been on a prayer walk, but...
I have not been on a prayer walk yet.
But I went on a prayer walk that was using spiritual mapping
to
do the prayer walk. And for people that are unfamiliar with this, you want to give the 10-cent version of what spiritual mapping is?
So as an...
I really put them on the spot.
As an early... what would you call him? Colleague of Wagner's, George Otis... developed what looks like, and this is where, the wording, again, George Otis would disagree with me. Actually, he's talked about this in his own books, like Informed Intercession, that he's developed an occult form of discernment for finding out dangerous places, spots, that because of things that might have happened in past history are housing demons, and therefore making an area hard to missionize, or in some cases, in smaller, versus national and regional, smaller cases, haunting houses, even haunting areas. Actually, I lost my thought on that one.
So George Otis's spiritual mapping looks at those places and tries to use history and historical sources
in a very unique way.
Implied. The locations where historical sins have taken place.
And then the job would be to go
to these places
and make, and this is just my phrasing, make reparations through prayers.
Oh, no, very much. John Dawson, the word that he uses is reconciliation.
Right.
And so there's very much that sense that we are... the demons that have appeared because of sins in the past. Those sins mm-hmm. were never reconciled, and therefore we carry them to this day. So we must go to the place that has the historical kind of connection temporally mm-hmm. and physically, and then repair the damage on that spot. So spiritual mapping is the like map that actually tells you where to go. It's the treasure map to the spots where reconciliation happens.
Right, so and what's interesting to jump in about this is, again, the muddiness in the interaction.
Absolutely.
In, I think I mentioned informed intercession a few minutes ago. Some of the citations that Otis uses positively are Llewellyn publications on ley lines. So Otis uses as text that can be trusted a publisher that's famous for Wiccan and neo-pagan publications.
Yeah, that's right.
And I think the argument he would give is that they actually know something about this and they're onto it. It's
right.
not that they invented it,
yes.
but however they have the wrong interpretations of these spots.
Yeah, that's right.
So again, it's about, it's the same thing with ghosts, right? It's like, well, yeah, you actually do have something in your house, but it's not a ghost, it's a demon.
Right.
And in fact, that demon's probably trying to trick you into thinking it's one of your relatives.
Right.
So it's, sometimes the activities look very similar, but of course the explanations for the activities are going to be very different.
Right. So I think that gets us back to the question I asked, which I know is hard because we've been talking for several minutes. So structurally, when we study these things, I think it you were saying you use primarily texts. Do you think that the textual source that you and I have both found to be able to talk about these things, that's the method to clear the waters, to make them less muddy? If we're not looking for origins, at least does that textual rootedness help us make our way in these things?
I think if anything, the texts, and it matters what text you're reading, right? But if you're reading spiritual warfare manuals alongside ghost hunter autobiographies, alongside self-help literature in the contemporary United States, then you have reached you almost reach an impasse, because the intertextuality is so deep in these things that it's not like you can say, well, obviously this first came from text A and then was transferred to text B. You can do that sort of intertextual reading with the spiritual warfare manuals itself, because as I'm sure you've seen, the miracle stories of healings, of finding that object to get rid of.
They're shared objects.
And they're passed from one book to the other.
That's right.
Right? These become like particular tales you'll see four or five times in different authors' books. Especially, you know, the Argentinian city of Resistencia. It's hard to say for me at this point. And how it had been plotted by Masons on. And how through spiritual warfare practices, through those prayer walks, through all sorts of engagements, eventually this town is turned into an evangelical Christian town.
Right.
The demons have been banished from the city, if you will. You know, you find these stories shared. But it actually goes beyond just those texts, right? Into, well, the story that Ryan Buell, who started the paranormal research group in Pennsylvania at Penn State, the story he tells looks so much like the story that Alice Patterson tells about her haunted house that we had to get the demons out of it because of a suicide that had occurred there in the past.
Yeah.
Very similar sorts of stories, right?
Yeah.
So where's the origin of these things?
Right.
Structurally, though, it also is muddy. Because, it's only muddy if you're looking for something original there, right? I don't know how you feel about it.
I like the way that you put it, right? You know, so when I made the dissertation proposal, how many years that was ago, right? now I'm done. One of the big problems they had with the way that I initially presented the project was, I want to talk about the origins of this thing, right? And we actually paused the recording a few minutes ago because the person who was sitting next to us, we're 50 feet from the Starbucks where there's a line of 75 people. The person next to us wanted to say that he was so fascinated by the discussion we were having, but he was an early, he said he was a Syrian? Yeah, Syrian stuff. And so he said, you know, I just want to say that everything you're talking about, we have sources for that in this early Christian world. And so I think you're right.
And
the,
when he was,
the search for origins is so very fun.
And when he said that, I was immediately thinking of David Brackey's work, Demons and the Making of the Monk.
Which I just...
And then I was later, and then later period, Walter Stevens, what are they called, Demon Lovers?
That's right.
But then I was even moving into the early 20th century and the folklorist Bill Ellis talking about the first recorded instance, at least in he could find, of pleading the blood, which is still something done, spiritual warfare practitioners today. And this was, what, 1902 or 1903 that he found recording of this.
So I think we're on the same page then, right? That the search for the particular nexus, the particular origin point, right, of this is kind of futile, right? It's only the origin of the particular threads that we're going to tease out at this moment that we can do. And those threads, such as the therapeutic discourse in America, they may have their own very complicated and unapproachable origins as well.
Right? That's right.
You don't have time for both the origins of the therapeutic movement and the origins of the therapeutic movement in spiritual warfare and, you know.
No, and I would think at this point, in terms of this movement, is that even a useful question?
Right.
And maybe it is for some scholars, but I think I'm more fascinated not by the origins of particular practices within spiritual warfare, but rather how it isn't unusual, how I see it in so many other places.
You know, it's funny, Rudy Busto, I don't know if you know him, said the same thing to me. He's like, you want to write about spiritual warfare, isn't that kind of like writing about why Catholics take communion?
I don't know if I'd agree with that much.
But I think you at least sense his point, right?
Oh, yeah.
This is just, it feels like it's, once you start looking, it feels like it's everywhere. Right, and it has its hands in every pot,
which should make every American religion scholar wanting to study it.
Yeah.
But at the same time, for some reason, and it may have to do with class locations, religious locations, various sorts of social locations, I think this is a movement that most scholars of American religion are still completely blind to, have no knowledge of, and if they do encounter it in some ways, they're still in the field, that sort of reaction. It's like, ugh, well, why would we study those silly people?
So that's a good segue maybe to a final area of topic, which is, it's okay, so what can we do if this is an area, right, that we think deserves more study? How can we be sensitive to it, present it in a way to others that will attract more people to see its merits?
And I think, ideally, what I was hoping... And again, the book probably won't even be out till the next AAR, even though I've turned it all in. What I was hoping to do in American Possessions is to do what Katie Lofton did do with Oprah, in that, again, a topic, Oprah Winfrey, that scholars may initially smirk at. But Katie presents Oprah in such a way to really talk about a wide swath of interests, topics, prescient themes in American religious history. And I think we can easily do the same thing with spiritual warfare, especially the group that we're both most interested in, this third wave New Apostolic Reformation type of spiritual warfare. It's not the only group that can tell you very important things about American religion in the late 20th, early 21st century. Of course not. But it can tell you things that I don't think other groups, a focus on other groups, may tell you, if that makes sense.
No, it does make sense to me. So just to expand that, you want to give maybe your one or two or three things that you think are the really key things that your addition of this as an entry point for these new issues. So what are the new issues that you think will really bubble to the surface?
Yeah, well, I think it goes back to my themes of the haunted, the consumerist, and the therapeutic. But also, to throw in a fourth point here, I'm really interested in how, and I'm going to use the term neoliberalism, but what is neoliberalism other than a lot of what we as scholars and in popular culture call neoliberalism is really classical liberalism, classical notions of individual selves who are autonomous, freely willed. So that ideology of the self in neoliberalism is also deeply at play in contemporary spiritual warfare, but in a very complex way, as I think we even started in a way conversing about this, because here's a group that accepts the notion that individuals should be freely willed, but at the same time, because of their theology, really denies that all individuals have 100% free will because of happenstance encounters going to those places and spaces where demons might be who could harass them, even though they might be free of sin. Also, though, because of generational inheritances that they get from their family, that you're never not tied to land and to family in some ways.
So you're powerful because you have the ability to do something about it, but you're also vulnerable in so many different ways.
And where does blame lie is something that a lot of the thing, one of the things I'm most fascinated, the last chapter of my of the book focuses on the language of free will and how spiritual warfare books are no different, I say, than most American discourse on free will, in which we go between blaming individuals for their social happenstances and then doing the opposite and saying, well, he or she is only like this because of the social milieu and locations they came out of. Again, spiritual warfare manuals are no different, but they do help, at least for me, they help focus some of these problems that the wider American public has about the notion of freely willed individuals and selves in what is a neoliberal era where, because of the structures of work, economy, are geared more and more toward the notion of individuals who do have the free will to do whatever they want, yet at the same time, as the social world plays out, some people are obviously disadvantaged in particular ways through the notion that we do have free will.
I think I still feel so very strongly that your perceptiveness about class, right? It's still coming through.
Yeah, it's still there.
You sound sad about that, though.
It's just typical, isn't it? Though,
yeah. But I think that's really. That's really an element of things that's so powerful about what you bring to the way in which you see it. Neoliberalism is not something that I would have necessarily seen.
Yeah.
Right. When I started to approach things, I thought maybe this is a response to urbanism. Right. Was one of my early thoughts. Like maybe this is a response to, you know, we're losing the battle in the cities.
Mm-hmm.
How do we win that battle? Mm-hmm. And I still think actually quite a lot of it is oriented in that direction. But
especially if you're focused on a spiritual mapping.
Oh yeah, absolutely. But at the same time, I don't know that I ever really thought that if I had perceived that the reason why the cities are in crisis is a class problem and a race problem, I don't know that the next step for me would have been to go and look at the role of the individual, right, and the role of agency and the kind of agency promoted by neoliberal. Like I would never have thought to do that.
And you're right, though. That directly comes out of the work I was doing in a book called Divine Hierarchies, in which I was fascinated by sermons, theologies that tended to explain class in particular ways. And there was a track of this sort of Arminian notion that you have 100% free will to choose salvation or damnation, and therefore also your status, your class position in life. And what fascinated me, because I have that in the back of my head as I'm reading through the spiritual warfare manuals, is how these manuals are so much more complex than that. Because at the same time as they tend to, the participants in spiritual warfare network, New Apostolic Reformation, these third wave folks tend to promote politically neoliberal politicians. At the same time, their theology is definitely not a purely neoliberal conception of self theology. And what looks to be confusing and inconsistent in their literature is no more confusing or inconsistent than popular public political debate in the United States about these very same issues.
So in that sense, they're truly representative.
I think so.
All right.
That would be the bold claim.
I think that's a great place to stop. So I want to thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you very much.
For joining me here and talking about our mutual passion. I hope that the book comes out very soon, because I think we need it. And I'm going to use it to then hawk my own book, which I think will do so much like yours to make these people the focus of the attention that they deserve. So thank you so much. And
excellent. Thank you very much, David.
Have a great rest of the conference here. We still have...
Next week, we've got two podcasts for you.
Yeah.
Interconnected podcasts, which were recorded last week. You had a very busy week last week, David.
I did have a crazy week last week.
Not only did you have your PhD viva, which, in case listeners didn't notice, he passed, by the way. Well, with minor corrections, he didn't refer to me enough in his thesis, so that was one thing that they wanted. But also, David was on a panel, which was a sort of authors meets critics for an edited volume called New Age Spirituality, Rethinking Religion, which has been edited by our friend, colleague, mentor, Dr. Stephen Sutcliffe and Ingvild Gilhus. So there was a Authors Meets Critics, and David was one of the critics, along with Dr. Bettina Schmidt and Dr. Marion Bowman.
Indeed. And we're going to be bringing you a recording of that session, or, you know, edited highlights thereof. But I also took the opportunity to interview Ingvild. I mean, she's a major, major scholar, you know. She's, at the moment, she's vice president of the IEHR, the International Association for the History of Religions, as well as a... you know, a very distinguished scholar in her field. I'm particularly interested in her work because she, like me, is interested in comparisons between religions in the classical world and what you might call popular religion in the modern world. I think that's a very fruitful area for investigation, and so it was good to sit down and talk to her about the subject of angels, which similarly straddle the last 2,000 years.
I haven't seen it yet, but I believe we are planning a trip, hopefully, to go and see Darren Aronofsky's Noah. And one thing that I have heard about Darren Aronofsky's Noah is that Russell Crowe, as Noah, has these sort of angels assisting him in the building of the ark.
Well, it'll be interesting to see how they portray those angels, because as we talk about in the interview next week, you know, they've been portrayed in a lot of different ways. In the original sort of New Testament descriptions, they're young men, no wings, dressed in white, and they're very much messengers. Whereas, obviously, in the modern kind of more New Age interpretations, they're very much supernatural beings, asexual, floating about in the air, not solid, certainly not wearing suits. You might get them in a sort of smock thing.
I just thought, you know, just since I'm just going to list random popular cultural references. Dogma, of course, isn't there? Isn't Alan Rickman an angel in that? Or am I getting, or in fact, are they?
I can't remember.
And obviously the his Dark Materials books have angels feature quite heavily in that, although we thankfully never got to see them on film because the Golden Compass was so awful.
Yeah, I'm thinking of the fairly poor film Constantine as well, with Keanu Reeves, but in that Lucifer appears, and Lucifer is of course a fallen angel, and again, they play with the idea of the being sort of asexual or agendered, even, and dressed in suits, and rather than these kind of super. Anyway, so we'll talk about that, and in particular about how it's called. I'm calling it unruly angels because we're talking about how angels personify the crossing of boundaries. Mm. You know, in lots of different gender roles, humans, gods. They're in between that. They break boundaries between sort of pagan and popular religion and Christianity, and, you know, interesting subject.
Excellent. And that'll link obviously quite well then into the book panel, you know, sort of be a sort of example of what people might class as New Age spirituality.
Yeah.
And then
the book is designed to apply empirical studies of you know, New Age phenomena, I'm doing the scare quotes there, with theories of religion, and Ingvild in particular makes useful comparisons with the classical world. So, yeah, you can see that as a case study about the broader sort of question being raised in the panel.
Brilliant. Well, thanks, David, for doing that interview, especially in that very busy week, and thanks to Ingvild. Sign off with our usual sort of... we're sponsored by the BASR. They're great.
Yeah. Facebook, Google+, iTunes...
Twitter,
Amazon.
And, yeah, Facebook. We're coming up... I think we're going to be at 2,000 before too long. So if you can help us, you know, spread the word again. A bit of love. We just got overtaken by Christian Peterson's new books in religion, and that's depressing. So we want to... We want to overtake him again. Okay, I think we've got a bit of friendly rivalry going on.
Yeah, smash them.
Yeah, burn the books.
But right now, maybe Jim Cox, you'd like to come in here and say our usual sign off.
Thanks for listening.
Thanks for listening.
Yours is better.
They're both Jim.